Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, big week. Acorn 7 came out, and this is the Mac for all the conversation about like Mac apps and, you know, where are the Mac apps? This is essentially Photoshop like image editing by an indie Mac developer, and it's a Mac app, and a big new version came out. I know you're a big fan.
Yeah, I am a big fan. I've used Acorn for many, many years. I mean, going back all the way probably to like some of my earliest Mac user days, where I just needed to like resize images or something, or do a cropping or something like that. And like, yeah, you can do a bunch of that in preview, but I've always felt like, you know, Acorn adds just that bit of extra capability. And Gus has done a great job. Gus Mueller, who's the developer, has done a great job of like adding stuff over the years, and it ends up being surprisingly powerful at times. Like last year when I was doing those self-published ebooks I did of my short stories, I did the cover art in Acorn. And it was one of those things where at some point I was like, oh man, I want to do this thing with like, you know, text that follows a path. Am I going to need to like get Photoshop or have somebody do this for me? And then I discovered, no, Acorn already does that. And I was like, wow, there's like so much in here that I don't use, because I'm mainly just using it for a handful of little things, but it's incredibly capable. And for something that I think is normally like $40, and currently the update's like 20 for half off right now, it is a steal. I mean, that is a incredibly powerful piece of software for a incredibly reasonable. I mean, like Photoshop is still either you're paying, what's like the monthly fee for Photoshop?
Well, you pay like $110 a year for Photoshop.
For Creative Suite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Photoshop. Yeah. Well, and even, right.
Yeah. So like
even Affinity Photo, which is now on sale, it's $50 on sale for $25 right now. And that would be but this is the point, is that there are Photoshop alternatives where you buy it once and you own it. You know, and again, there'll be an update later that you'll need to buy, but you're not on that subscription model. And for most people,
it's like every couple of years for
I mean,
Acorn,
I'm a Photoshop
too.
Guy, but that's mostly because I've been using Photoshop for nigh on 30 years now. And
right. Sure.
But, you know, I even bought Acorn if Adobe cranked up the price of Photoshop, I would seriously consider dropping off the Photoshop train, just because there are so many other options that provide incredible value and that are good Mac apps. And you know, I appreciate that about. I'm appreciating good Mac apps, right? I always have.
Yeah, exactly.
But these days, there's another round of sort of like. I feel like in the old days there were not that many Mac apps, and the Mac apps that did exist were like bad cross-platform ports, and then there were also good ones. And now I feel like we're in an era where there's more available Mac software than ever, which is great, but also a lot of it is sort of crappy cross-platform stuff. And so it's
Electron,
there's varying
like
degrees of quality there, but like I really appreciate it when there is somebody who I know is committed to the Mac building good software for the Mac. And right before we started the podcast, I mentioned that I was using RetroBatch the other day, which is also by Flying Meat, makers of Acorn, and that's like an automator workflow for images, and it's such a cool idea. And you know, I love that stuff, and I love that people are still making really great Mac software.
Yeah, I always try to find. I'm on the lookout for more stuff like that, and I think, ironically, in some ways, it's gotten harder to find sometimes. Like, the Mac App Store makes it easier for some cases, but there's a lot more stuff in there, and it's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff and all of that. So I spent a lot of time thinking, like, oh, I want to find more really good, like, indie Mac apps. And, you know, it's harder to just, like, organically discover those things.
Yeah, it is. Occasionally, I'll find something because I'm looking for it, and I'll write about it, and this is why I like writing about this stuff, and why I always appreciated back when Dan Frakes was doing Mac Gems. Like, it's work to dig this stuff up. And the truth is that you like, when I was looking for a HomeKit app, I tried like five. And I wrote about the one that I liked the best. So there's this effort where you're like trying this stuff and you're like, oh no, I'm not going to recommend this. But what's incredibly gratifying is when you find something and you write about it, you end up hearing from people who are like, oh, I had no idea this existed. And that they get really excited and they use that software. And I love that. I love finding that stuff because it is hard to find. And it is so delightful when you do find something that works for you.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and I do think the Mac still has a really great software community, especially an indie software community. I think I would say even over things like iOS, you know, for me, the Mac still has a just a really a tight knit and like, I don't know, there's an attention to detail and stuff like that. And some of that has come out of the long history of the platform. And some of it is just, I don't know, it's just, it's always proved to be a good place to develop apps,
and,
I feel
and
like.
While I have used and will continue to use cross-platform apps that aren't as good because they're cross-platform, but they're great because they do something that I need. I'm thinking of like our video streaming apps that we use, like OBS or Wirecast or something like that, which are they're not good Mac apps, but they, at least they run on the Mac. I'm always going to have a strong preference for an app that cares enough to honor platform conventions. And I mentioned this.
Yes,
this is one of my big pet peeves that I actually mentioned in a link post. Because Alex Gayat over at Mac Stories wrote his review of Nova, which is a website development tool from Panic Software. It's the sequel to Coda, their old tool that they renamed because they sold the name to someone, which is a weird story. And as an aside in his story, he talks about how he's used all of these cross-platform code editors that he hates because they every time you... Here's how he phrased it. You can see a microcosm that of the fact that they are cross-platform apps with design senses that differ from Mac-first developers by looking at the preferences of those apps. And I'm like, oh, is he going to do it? Is he going to say it? And here it is. For many of them, the preferences menu bar item is actually a submenu from which you can navigate to settings as well as more nebulous options. If that doesn't already offend Mac users, a common theme in those settings screens is for them to be literal JSON text files that open in the editor. You then manually edit the text to adjust options. This is, I have tried this with a bunch of these apps, and I'm sorry, if your preferences are going to be in a text file, even if you're a text editor, it's like, hard no. I'm never going to use your app because that is... I just got to say it. That's the laziest thing I've ever seen. And it's so not Mac-like to be like, oh, well, you're using a text editor, so you obviously love editing preferences in a text file.
Text. That's what you're here for. It's one thing if you're using like, you know, you and I have both used like web software that has like text, Homebridge, right? Homebridge has that kind of thing where it's like there is an interface, but it's also fundamentally their preferences are like a JSON file. But
it's also not pretending to be software. A Mac app, right?
It's not a Mac app.
It's like Unix-y under the hood kind of software.
Like, it's fine. You got to know
your context. Exactly right. And I'm okay if there's like hidden secret settings and stuff. But like, if you go to Sublime Text and you open the preferences, it's just like, here's a file. And again, if you feel differently and you're like, well, no, but I like VS Code so much that I don't care that I have to edit the preferences in a text file, that's fine. I'm not going to judge you for it. You obviously have a different set of standards than me. I'm not saying mine are better, but I'm saying that like I'm a Mac user for a reason, and I am offended when these apps don't punt on something so simple as settings and putting a proper UI on something and saying, we don't need a proper UI. And Mac developers who are Mac first developers, they're never going to do that. They're never going to do that. So
no, yeah. Even in a text editor, right?
Even in a text editor, yes.
BBEdit has like pains and pains of preferences that you can set, but they're not going to kick it.
And BBEdit has, it has secret settings too,
sure.
But it actually has
an idiosyncrasy.
It actually has there's one of the items in BBEdit's preferences is at the very bottom is expert. And it literally is, there are also secret settings. Click here to see what they are. And those are the ones you have to do with like a Unix command or something. But that's how they handle it. I don't know. I'm not saying like BBEdit is the be all end all. I've chosen it. But again, speaking of 30 years of legacy, I've got like 25 years of legacy with BBEdit. But my point is that when you look at something like Acorn, you know, that's not going to happen because it's a Mac app. Plus, it's a, I think, pretty great deal for people who might not want to be on the Photoshop train. That's my point.
Exactly.
And that's how I feel about, I mentioned Affinity Photo, which is, one of Affinity's, design apps that are like I want to say the kind of knockoff of the Adobe Suite, but you can just buy them. But I've been using Affinity Designer. And I wrote about this a while ago as my replacement. I used to keep a copy of Illustrator CS5 around, and it was finally like 32-bit. It finally was it was already buggy, but then it was just not going to run after the 32-bit apocalypse in Catalina. And I bit the bullet and bought Affinity Designer, And it's just, it's great. It does everything that I would ever need out of Illustrator, because I'm not an Illustrator user. I would use it a handful of times a year. And our friend Anthony Johnston does all of his work in Affinity Designer now. He used to do it in Illustrator. And Anthony does a lot of the, in addition to being a successful novelist and comic book writer and all sorts of other things that he does, Anthony has a long history as a designer. And he designs a lot of the podcast art for The Incomparable these days. And that's all in Affinity Design. And I'm very impressed by that as well. Like, it's really great. And I'm so happy because, again, my usage level of Photoshop might justify me paying for Photoshop. But my usage level of Illustrator would never have justified it. And instead, I just bought Affinity Designer and I'm good. So I love that there are these alternatives out there and that they're pretty good on the Mac. Got to check and see. Designer have a preferences window, or do you have to edit a text file? I think you probably don't have to edit a text file in Affinity Designer. Just my guess. What else is going on, Dan? Anything?
Well, I want to discuss a little. Can we get a little inside baseball for one second? Because I had to laugh at this, which is there were predictions of a March event.
Oh, yes.
An Apple event. And, you know, this came from a few different sources, including some of this new, I don't know, people have started making a distinction for this, like, new things, the leakers, right? It's not the rumor mongers or whatever, but there's the leakers.
It's not a thing. They're no different. Like, they're literally no different. The people,
it's the
leakers,
same thing. It's just
I know I'm going to lose
self-branding.
Yeah, I'm going to lose this one, but like a leaker is the person who actually is on the inside who is leaking. If you're taking
these people
information
are,
and spreading it. Now,
you're a taker?
I will admit, rumors are not quite right either, right? Like, they're reports.
Sure. No.
But they are leaks that they're being spread, but the leaker is not the person spreading the leaks.
And there are clearly also people sending leaks. There was that big story about that guy that Apple has sued, essentially.
That guy was a leaker.
Who was the former employee.
That's a leaker.
Right? That guy was a leaker. Yeah. Anyways, I guess my point to this was everybody was putting their chips down on this March 23rd date. And it came, you know, not to say it could not happen, but it probably won't, since usually Apple gives like a week's roughly heads up on these things these days. Also, not to say they couldn't just release some products next on the 23rd, right? Could happen, sure. But what I really enjoy from this is those who really put their money down on it, who then said, like, well, we believe that Apple was like seeding disinformation on this. And I think this is hilarious, Jason, because I think it's one of those things where it's also like, it's a little bit like conspiracy theories where you can't ever be proved wrong, right? Because you can't prove a negative. And it's like, oh, well, I say that this was done as disinformation. It's because I'm getting too close, Jason. I'm getting too close to the real truth. Anyways, just kidding. Now it's April. Totally April this time.
Eventually they'll be
right.
It was
not implausible. Eventually they will be right. Yes. And I know lots of people like to run the numbers on these things and say they're right this percentage of times or whatever. I take all of these things with a gigantic grain of salt, because both you and I have read these things for years, if not decades, and know that rarely is anybody right more than 50% of the time. Right.
Well, and part of that is that even if your sources are good, things change.
You're only seeing part of the picture,
too. I had an example of this this week that I linked to about a Mark Gurman report. And again, it's not a leak because it's Mark Gurman. He's a reporter. He's reporting. He's reporting on information. It's not a rumor. He's a reporter. But Mark Gurman's story, based on sources inside Apple who would know, is about new iPads, which he says are on tap for April, which was funny because, of course, not March, as early as April, he says. And again, you got to watch the details, right? As early as April.
Right. Could be later.
The thing that tickled me in there, there are a couple things that I love the precision of this. And again, this is somebody who works, despite the issue that they've got with that really dumb big hack story that they've done a couple of times. I do know people who work at Bloomberg. They generally have, I don't know what's going on with that story, they generally have very high standards for like, especially on the copy desk, for like the precision of what you're reporting. And Mark Gurman, who was at 925 Mac before, he when he came over, you could see his writing change, and it was the influence of the standards at Bloomberg in terms of like the copy desk and how it could phrase things. Anyway, what he says is, Apple is also looking to include a mini LED screen with at least the larger model. I think is interesting, right? Because it doesn't mean that they aren't going to do both. It means he only knows that they're looking at the larger model, which is says something about his sources' access. And it's not just like access level, but it's also when they saw. I get the impression that some of this stuff, the source is like not supposed to see it, but sees it in passing at some point.
Yeah, it says like 2 months ago they were talking about this, or six months ago they were talking about this.
Which affects your accuracy, right? Because you're reporting on something that was half seen a couple months ago. It may have changed, and I think that that's where a lot of the misses end up happening, is not because that wasn't a real thing that was going on, but that it's changed. And the other one that I want to mention, because this really tickled me, is in testing, the new iPad Pros have used a Thunderbolt connector. The port doesn't require new chargers. So this suggests that he talked to somebody or somebodies who had used test versions of the iPad Pro. Right. But we know that occasionally something gets pulled out, right? And you can usually see iFixit will show, here it is on the logic board where that thing was, but they took it out and they didn't ship it. So he can't say for sure that they're going to have Thunderbolt instead of USB-C, because that's not what his source has. His source only has, in testing, they had Thunderbolt, which is, I love it.
Again, to your point, timelines are important, right? We are talking, it is, as we record this, March 19th. Yeah. April is less than 2 weeks
away. If they're shipping it next month, they're making them already.
It's done.
They're making them.
It's finished, right? Yeah, exactly. That product
is
finished.
But Mark Gurman's source doesn't know what's in the finished one. He
hasn't seen the finished
product. That person
product,
only knows what that test model that they saw was that needed, that doesn't require a new charger, but it's Thunderbolt.
and Apple, as we have talked about before, Apple makes lots of prototypes, right? Maybe not tons, but like on a product as new as the iPad's been around for many years, and so they're probably not making as many prototypes as they have in earlier days of the iPad, or probably in the lead up to the first iPad. But there's still a lot of different options that are being tested. They're testing different display options. They're testing probably different connectors there, or putting connectors in for testing purposes, right? Like there's a lot of things that can change what a device is between its development and its shipping. And that's I think that's one of the few things that lets any mystique remain around Apple products these days, because there are a lot of cases where the products have leaked ahead of time, or at least crucial details have come out ahead of time. You know, we've been, you and I have both been at and watched Apple events where it's like, yeah, we knew
all
like 75% of what they talked about, if not
a
all.
A lot of it, and this is another funny thing,
sometimes it's
a lot
details,
of it
though.
is in the days before the event. And so a couple of things. One is, I wonder how doing virtual events has changed things. Because it used to be they would do rehearsals for real events, and they'd have real staff doing run-throughs of the real events. And I imagine that the more people you've got involved in something like that, the more room there is for information to leak out. But they're now they're doing it where it's just a video production, and it's actually even pandemic protocols. So the number of people involved in the video production is limited, and they may not all be seeing all of it. So like I wonder how that's changed. And honestly, this thing about the date, similarly, like it used to be. First off, it used to be that Apple had to actually reserve a space in a public place, not on Apple's campus, and that is how we knew dates well in advance. And even on Apple's campus, you have to set up. They end up bringing in like retail people to work the crowd and to get people checked in and moving through the campus and not going off the path and all of those things, right? And that's all gone. So not only is the opportunity, like the attack surface for leaks, reduced, but if you're Apple and you've got your video package ready to go, you can say let's push it back a week, and literally all you have to do is say that, and nothing changes because it's not like there's even a label on the date of it, right? It's good morning.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that stuff, I mean, you know, they're probably, when you think about it a little more, when you go into the production angle, you think, well, they're also probably filming on like days that make sense to film, right? Like working around Tim's schedule, or even, and I just thought about this because I think it's funny, they're waiting for like a sunny day.
Yes.
Oh, it's overcast today. Let's not record today. Yep. You know, like that's, and it is, it's incredibly, it's kind of thrown everything for a loop. And I'm fascinated to see, and you know, this links in a little bit to, there was a Tim Cook interview in People, I want to say, yesterday, talking about sort of remote work and the future of like, you know, Tim and his Tim ways, saying, I can't wait till we get everybody back so that people can run into each other in corridors and have great ideas. But he also points out that, you know, the hybrid model of having some work done remotely has proved to be beneficial for a lot of things, or there are definitely cases where they've accomplished a ton of stuff, you know, remotely, and it has not impinged the way that they do their work. But yeah, I don't know. If I were Apple, I would be strongly thinking about, does it make sense for us to have press fly out all the time, right? Maybe we only do a couple events a year, and then a couple are just video rollouts. Do we, I mean, and, you know, we've all talked a bunch about the future of WWDC because there are huge advantages to the way they did it last year, right? You don't have to worry about, you know, having the money to fly to San Jose and be able to stay in a hotel, or being able to get one of the few tickets that are available, like being able to go to multiple, like, you know, there are all these tracks and things running at the same time. You don't have to worry about managing your schedule. And you lose stuff too, right? You definitely lose stuff. But man, I don't know. The benefits in many cases for their putative audience, the benefits certainly seem to outweigh the drawbacks.
Yeah, I don't know, because there's part of my brain that just says, why would you ever go back?
Right. Right. And that makes me incredibly sad, because there are definitely people I will like never see again.
Yeah, WWDC is a hard one because the community actually has
that was the last one.
Value in it. But if I'm Apple and I'm looking at their value for money, and you know, it's a tough one. I still am going to guess that, but this is not a very strong prediction, but I'm still going to guess that they're going to attempt to do an event eventually at for WWDC, but I don't think it's going to be the same. I think it'll be, I think that most of the sessions will be released online as the current virtual version is, and that it'll be more like they'll do like a keynote, and they'll do State of the Union, and they'll have like overview things, and they'll have labs, and and it might not even be a 5-day event.
I was gonna say, maybe it's a long weekend or something.
Yeah,
who knows?
Maybe it's like, well, I mean, that would reduce cost, right? You still got your travel costs.
Sure.
To reduce cost, to have it be down to like 3 days or 2 days or something like that.
Yeah.
But
or hell, maybe they'll just throw a big party.
I could make a strong argument. Yeah, you just do the, it's a keynote in the bash, and then we're done.
Yeah, I mean, or it's like, you know, Macworld Expo was a very different beast. Apple did use it as a launching ground for many years, but it was, you know, it was the community predominantly, and it was not run by them. It was run by IDG and other, were there other people before that?
Always IDG.
But yeah, like you get all these other conferences or conventions, right, with people gathering, Comic Cons and stuff like that. And, you know, those all have their own challenges in the post-COVID world, but I, you know, part of me would not rule out the idea that Apple would have a WWDC event that also had potentially more of a, because the problem in recent years was always can't get a ticket, right? You know, if you're, there's 5,000 people are let in or whatever, and there's way more potential developers than that. So I don't know. Maybe there is an opportunity for it to include the larger stuff as it's taken to doing in recent years, right? It made sort of official, you know, deals, or, you know, at least had connections with things like AltConf and Layers and other stuff that was going on, right? They got much more welcoming of those ancillary events when they realized, oh, well, we can't have everybody in WWDC, right? We just don't have the logistics for that. So maybe there is a social like part of that as well, that they feel like, well, there's still enough value from that for us to do something that's a little bit different. But I agree with you that it's not going to look like it did 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's for sure. If it comes back at all, which it would be a shame
if it comes
for the,
back
for the reason, I mean, this is it, right? Is I just like that there's a place, and WWDC became the place where the, you know, where the community could get together, and that's like everybody writes about it and all the indie developers, and like people can go, choose to go, and then they're all there together, and it's such a nice thing to have, like a place and a reason for people to go. And it would be a shame. You almost don't need the thing, right? Like, so many of the people who came to San Jose and before it San Francisco were not actually there to go to the conference. It was like the conference was the grain of sand that caused the pearl to form. But it was really just about, give us an excuse. And the challenge is, like, I can't just say, well, they're not doing WWDC anymore, so everybody just visit me in San Francisco in July. Because that doesn't work, right? Like, you can't. There needs to be a critical mass, and it was formed by Macworld, and then it was formed by Apple and the developer conference. So that's why. And honestly, I think that's the only reason how it will come back is that Apple feels like they need a showcase physical event, and that virtual is not enough, and they need to supplement it with something that is real. That's the reason to keep doing it. Otherwise, why? Otherwise, there's no reason.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Anything else going on? I feel like we're all just anticipating.
It's something so quiet
it
right
seems
now.
Something is probably coming, but it is pretty quiet right now. The rumors are out there. There's some stuff that's coming. I also feel like we're in a lull. We got the M1 last fall, and it seems still, and the reports that we've gotten seem to suggest this too, that like Apple's not going to really do another Mac chip maybe until next fall. Mm. And so this is, we're in this interesting place where we're in Apple Silicon era now. We're in the Apple Silicon era, but all we have are those three M1s. And
yeah,
I do wonder, we don't know. We don't know if there is an M1X coming or something like that. But it's entirely possible that what we're seeing is this interesting kind of break where Apple's not ready for the next one. And the next one might be an iteration on the M1. The next one might not be till the fall where there's something like an M2. We don't know. But like, we're in this interim state now. And the real question for me this spring is, are there new Macs at all? The iMac has been a rumor, but my question then is, what is the chip in that iMac? Is it an M1? Is it an M1X that is still an M1, but it's got more cores? It's just this weird interim state of, like, we don't know the pace of anything because there's only been one.
Right. It's interesting to look at the pace of development on the iOS side, where they've kind of bounced back and forth, right? They've had their A number and then their A number X, usually. And then we had that weird blip last year, right, where they went to the A12Z.
Yeah.
And I don't think ever be an iPad with an A13, or at least a new, you know, iPad with an A13.
Maybe. No, it seems unlikely. It'll have an A14. You know, the regular iPad will get an A14 in like 3 years, but it won't be the X, or a 13, or it'll get the A13. But not
exactly.
No,
but the iPad Pro is never. But the iPad Pro is not even going to. There was no A13 at all in any of the iPads because they went from the A12Z, and all of a sudden, if we get a new Pro soon, it's probably an A14X.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Look a lot
they
like
could
the
call M1. It an A14. They could call it an A14Z if they're like, yeah, we added another extra core. I don't know. Like, they could. It's a branding thing.
It
they could do it if they wanted to. But
it doesn't mean anything. Doesn't do and my pet theory is that the reason that the A13X doesn't exist is because they were too busy on the M1.
Right, yeah. And I mean, and by all accounts, the A14 and the M1 are close cousins. So it seems likely that that chip line or whatever is already kind of, you know, well along enough that the A14X makes a lot of sense. And they're probably not going to be an A15 because Apple really seems to like tying that to the phones. Like, I think they like tying the new generations to the phones because those are still the flagship products. So, you know, the iPad has the same chip, but with more graphic capability, which also kind of needs because it's got a much bigger screen. So, you know, I think that the idea of an M1X is not unreasonable at all, but you have to ask yourself, what is the benefit, right? Because if the X traditionally is something that brings better graphics performance, all right, an iMac, again, much larger screen. You can see that there might be some need to have, like, boost the graphics performance a bit. but it's still potentially going to be limited to those RAM limits and those port limits. And I have a hard time feeling like the iMac is going to do well with that, because if it only can support a couple, you know, USB ports and 16 gigabytes of RAM, that's a low-end iMac. That is not an iMac that, especially having just discontinued the iMac Pro, this is not a, there's no high-end substitute then. You're still going to be on Intel for a while.
I mean, I think there's a real question about, like, can you release a low-end iMac with the ports that are on the Mac Mini? But that's a little bit light for an iMac. Even with the extra ports that the laptops don't have, it's a little bit light on an iMac. So you're right. I think if I had to guess, I would guess that there will be an iMac and it will have like an M1X, and there'll be just like a better M1, but not, you know, not M2, not next generation, because that's going to be in the fall, presumably, just like the iPhone chips come out in the fall. But the fact is, we don't know. Like, we don't know what their strategy is here. And, you know, they might be able, if you look at the Mac Mini, they could get away with doing an iMac that is the performance of the Mac Mini and have it be the low-end iMac and keep the high-end iMac around and be like, well, more to come, and then walk away.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that seems not unlikely to me, though. I think people will... There will be a lot of vitriol potentially, or just a lot of people ranting about it. But again, it's the same problem that we had with the MacBook Pro.
People are ranting about
this is the low end.
People are ranting about the M1 because it's not high end, because it's not high end, and people will find ways to complain about it. Right? Get Intel on the phone and make some ads about it.
I will say, I think that that's very plausible, but it's hard to, as you say, it's hard to predict because we basically only have one data point.
There's no pattern. Right?
We don't have a line yet. We have a point.
Yep. So it's tricky. That's what I'm saying. It's tricky. But this is the lull we're in. And that was my point, is sort of like, this is why we're in this lull, I think, is that we don't know what's coming. We don't know what the Mac plan is and can't really divine it. Like, the timing of all the reports about like when Macs are coming out doesn't really explain quite what Apple's strategy is. And so as much as the mystery of will Apple go to ARM, remember that? You know, that one's over. We're done. Mm-hmm. We got it. We're in that era now. How they do the rest of this remains a mystery. So more to come, maybe sometime eventually. But I wouldn't entirely bet on there being new Macs until like June, but you know, maybe we'll be lucky and we'll get them in April.
Plausible to me. I will see. I will bet on the iPad Pro in the spring.
Yeah,
and an announcement to be named later.
Okay, that's right. We'll trade that for cash considerations. All right. Well, we'll be back next week. It'll be still March, always March. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.